On his death in 1953, an admirer declared, "More than any other man, Hilaire Belloc made the English-speaking Catholic world in which all of us live." For G.K. Chesterton, he was the man who has made the greatest fight for good things of all the men of my time. In his life, Hilaire Belloc became a politician, a journalist, a traveler, a poet, an essayist, a novelist, and an historian. Perhaps what he best wished to be remembered for is contained on his own epitaph. "I challenged and I kept the faith. The bleeding path alone I trod. It darkens. Stand about my wraith and harbor me, Almighty God." Well, because he kept the faith as well as he did, he most certainly is a defender of faith, and he most certainly is a very wonderful subject for us to be looking at in this series on defenders of faith in word and deed. This great Catholic who kept the faith was born July 27th, 1870, in the village of La Celle-Saint-Cloud, about 12 miles from the city of Paris. His mother was Elizabeth Parks. She was British, and she had been brought up in the Unitarian faith in the city of Birmingham, England. She was the great-granddaughter of the famous English scientist Joseph Priestley. And when she was a young woman, she once made a trip to Ireland. She was so impressed with the Catholic faith of the Irish people that she became a Catholic herself. And in later years, she married a gentleman by the name of Louis Belloc. Louis Belloc was a French barrister, and in the course of their rather brief married life, Mr. and Mrs. Belloc and their family alternated their time between that French village of La Celle-Saint-Cloud and the city of London. Louis Belloc had been in rather poor health, and he died rather suddenly in 1872, leaving his widow and his children in somewhat dire financial straits. So Mrs. Belloc took her young family back to England, and they secured a country house in a town called Slendon in Sussex. One of his biographers writes this: "This was Belloc's first acquaintance with the country, which was later to play so important a part in his life and in his writings. For 2 years, he passed the greater part of his life there with his mother in undisturbed enjoyment of the beauty of the surroundings." Well, when he was 10 years of age, young Hilaire Belloc was sent to the Oratory School in the city of Birmingham, that famous school that had been begun by John Henry Cardinal Newman. He was a brilliant student, and he wanted to give himself to writing. He saw this as his lifetime career. But his mother did not want him to become a writer. She thought it was not a very promising career. It was a very iffy kind of a career. Could he really make a living at it? What if his works didn't sell and so forth? So she got him apprenticed as a farmer on the grounds of the Duke of Norfolk. She thought that if he became a professional farmer, he would have a better life. Well, now, he tried farming ever so briefly, and there were certain things about farming that he seemed to like. There were certain things about the outdoor life that he seemed to like, but it certainly was not going to be his principal calling in life. That was for certain. And so he did not last all that terribly long working on the grounds of the Duke of Norfolk. In 1889, he met a young woman named Elodie Hogan. And soon afterwards, he became engaged to her. The Hogans were an Irish family who had left Ireland during the famine and had settled in California. And Elodie and her sister were once visiting England, and they had an introduction to Madame Belloc. And through Madame Belloc, young Elodie met her son, Hilaire Belloc. And they were engaged, but they were not married for quite a few years. Elodie was a very, very devout young woman, and she was back and forth about whether or not she should enter religious life herself. She very seriously considered a religious vocation, and she spent some time living in a convent in Baltimore, trying to see if this was indeed to be her calling in life. Well, it was not to be her calling in life, and she, as a result, came back to England, and she and Hilaire Belloc were married. In the meantime, Belloc spent 1 year in the military, after which he went to Oxford. He won a scholarship to Balliol College, and he had a brilliant academic career at Balliol College in Oxford. He became very well known as a debater and a speaker on the Oxford Union, and he actually became president of the Oxford Union. And also during his school years, he won what was called the Brackenberry Prize for History, which was a very, very coveted academic prize at Oxford in those days. He was very interested in becoming an Oxford Don, a professor, if you will, at the great University of Oxford. And the competition for such a thing was very, very stiff. Well, Hilaire Belloc entered the competition, but he did not win. The prize, the history professorship, if you will, went to someone else. It was a tremendous disappointment to him. But in retrospect, it was probably one of the best things that ever happened to him, because the tremendous breadth of his insight, of his knowledge, the variety of interests that he was to have in life would have been stifled, no doubt, if he purely and simply had limited himself to living the life of an Oxford Don. So he was not going to be a professor at Oxford. What precisely was he going to be? How was he going to make a living? Well, it was at this point in his life that he determined, the only way I'm really going to make a living is to become a professional writer, so I'd better get at it. The first thing he did in being a professional writer was to write a collection of verse, which he later tore up and threw away. He didn't think the verse was terribly good. But he began writing books on the French Revolution. He wrote a book on the city of Paris, which had a very fine understanding of both the history and the topography of the city of Paris. He is also well remembered for a delightful book that he wrote at this time called The Path to Rome. It describes the meanderings that he took one time on a journey to the Eternal City, and it is a delightfully written book. Belloc had been living in the borough of Chelsea, which is a part of the city of London, but he moved down to Sussex to try to find a more suitable home for his wife and his growing family. And when they went down to Sussex, they did find a very beautiful home in West Grinstead, which was called, and still is called to this day, Kingsland. Kingsland was going to be the home of Hilaire Belloc until his death in 1953. And the home, Kingsland, is very close to the Shrine Church of Our Lady of Consolation in West Grinstead. You may go there today to the churchyard and visit the graves of Hilaire and Elodie Belloc. And in the rectory of the church, you may see a hiding place for Catholic priests. The rectory goes all the way back to Reformation times, when priests were actively hunted in England and were looking for discreet hiding places. Well, this rectory in West Grinstead was one of those hiding places dating to Reformation times. So Kingsland was to be his office, where he did much of his writing. It was where he raised his family. It was, and indeed it still is today, a very, very beautiful British home. Hilaire Belloc served in the British Parliament as a member of the Liberal Party for about 5 years, from 1906 to 1911, and he became rather disillusioned with party politics. He began his own newspaper at this time, and he began writing exposés about much of the corruption that he saw going on in the British parliamentary system. At the same time, he was trying to put forth his political views as best he could. Well, in these years, and we are up to about 1914 now, as his career was progressing, tragedy struck. His young wife, Elodie, died at the age of 42, and this left him a crushed man. He wore black for the remainder of his life. He took very few speaking engagements. He stopped writing for quite a while. He went into a complete depression following the death of this woman whom he loved so much. But finally, he realized he had to come out of that depression, and he bought a weekly review, which was called Land and Water. He began writing articles in that weekly review on the progress of the First World War, and he began making periodic visits to the front, and the results of those visits, of course, became articles in his weekly review, Land and Water. And this thing grew in popularity, and Hilaire Belloc became a very popularly sought-after speaker and writer in the British public, particularly on the subject of the progress and Britain's progress during the First World War. Well, the remaining decades of Hilaire Belloc's life following the death of his wife took on the pattern, if you will, the same pattern of many of his earlier years. He shared his enormous breadth of knowledge through lecturing and writing, and the greatest contributions that he made in these later years of his life seem to have come in the areas of history, politics, and apologetics. And in all of those three areas, we find the faith of Hilaire Belloc permeating. As one of his biographers wrote, he saw the world not as a conglomeration of races and disparate individuals, but as a place in which men and women fall into two groups. On the one hand, those who had received the gift of faith and knowledge of the truth. On the other hand, those who pursue a medley of will of the wisps, each deviating in one way or another from the truth, and hence deceptive and harmful. That conviction colored all his writing. In other words, you were either a person of faith or you were a person following a contrary path. But he saw the world in that way. It was very, very black and white. You were in one camp or you were in another. Well, as an historian, Hilaire Belloc believed that traditional British history was not objective. Traditional British history, he said, is fundamentally anti-Catholic. Much of the history that he had studied when he was a student at Oxford was permeated with the idea of progress, the assumption that society naturally improved the further society moved away from the Catholic Middle Ages. The further you got away from the dominant influence of the Catholic Church, in other words, the more you were to experience progress. So, the Catholic Church and medieval times, according to most British historians, represented everything that we ought to forget about. The Catholic Church and medieval times, according to Hilaire Belloc, represented everything that was good. And in developing this idea, Belloc very freely admitted that he was much more a publicist than he was an historian. One rather admiring biographer attempted to capture the publicist in Hilaire Belloc, and this is what he wrote. In his enthusiasm, he was often over-emphatic, simplistic, judgmental, and erroneous. His histories were true in their soul, if not always in their substance. He was certainly interested in historical facts and frequently argued in pursuit of them. But he was primarily interested in facts as building blocks for his mystical temple, so that his facts were sometimes wrong. They were never lies. They just were not completely correct. His histories should be read, then, not so much for their facts, though there are plenty of these, but for his vision of what the facts should be. Good thing to keep in mind in reading the many, many works of Hilaire Belloc. He was far more a publicist than he was an historian. Now, many of his histories, for example, his History of England, his work on how the Reformation happened, his work on Cardinal Wolsey and so forth, many of these works presented the Reformation as the most important event in the history of Europe from the conversion of the Roman Empire until modern times. The Reformation, he believed, resulted, and we quote him, in the destruction of Christendom's unity, the elimination of medieval liberties and democratic structures, the dispossession of the poor by the rich, the development of an astonishing individualism, and the creation of a new oligarchy which evolved into the industrial capitalist class. So you see, he looked at the Reformation very, very much in economic terms, and particularly as it represented the growth of this rich industrial capitalist class who were intent on putting down the poor. That was at least one man's view. So what Belloc was doing was rejecting the very traditional view that the Reformation was a popular movement. Rather, it was a movement of the powerful, if you will, against the Catholic faith. And as the rich and as the powerful had engineered the English Reformation, so everything that happened in Britain subsequently ensured the success of that Reformation. It was rather the Catholic Church that was the balancing force. It was the Catholic Church that presented all the good in the world. He saw the Church as rescuing civilization. She began rescuing civilization at the time of the Roman Empire, and she continued to rescue civilization all through her glorious history. And she would continue rescuing civilization from these rich and powerful industrial capitalist classes in England who had very effectively brought about the Reformation. France was the eldest daughter of the church, said Belloc, and this work of the Catholic Church was found in France par excellence, but it would be found in each and every country of Europe. And that is why when he wrote his book in 1920, Europe and the Faith, he concluded that book with something that has become a very famous statement. The last sentence of the book, Europe is the faith, and the faith is Europe. That was a statement that became very, very well known in his time and has been quoted many times since. Hilaire Belloc, in his writings, geared all of them to four classes of people, primarily. To the Catholics of England. To the Irish Catholics living in England, who formed such a large part of the British Catholic population. To the hundreds and indeed thousands of converts, particularly in England, who had come into the church, and especially who would come into the church from the established Church of England. And finally, to the recusant Catholic families, those old and ancient Catholic families who had remained Catholic since the time of the Reformation. This was the reading audience, primarily, of Hilaire Belloc during his own time. No one did more, one biographer said, to give the English Catholics confidence in themselves and to make them feel part of the European tradition. Well, as we said, as a young man, Hilaire Belloc had been a member of the Liberal Party. He had been a member of Parliament from 1906 to 1911. And during those years in Parliament, he tried to speak up on issues that were of interest to the Catholic cause. He spoke up on the issue of Ireland. He spoke up on the issue of Catholic education. But aside from those uniquely Catholic issues, you do not hear too many profound statements out of Hilaire Belloc during his years in which he was an MP, as the British said. But as we mentioned, he did become more and more out of sorts, I think we can say, with the whole idea of British politics and those who made British politics. Belloc believed that since the Reformation, British politics had been very much intertwined with religion, that is, the religion of the established church. And, he said, the requirements and the priorities of the rich and the powerful, and therefore the established church members, had been elevated to a form of sacredness, and therefore, in the minds of the British public, this was all beyond legitimate criticism. MPs were not to be criticized, the established church was not to be criticized, the rich and powerful capitalists in Britain, they were all one and the same, according to Belloc. They were not to be criticized. Well, upon his leaving Parliament, he met the well-known English Dominican Father Vincent McNab. And it's often been said that these two men, Father Vincent McNab and Hilaire Belloc, fueled each other's vocation to preach about the right of the poor to property and the evils of capitalism. Hilaire Belloc's distrust of the British establishment reached its sharpest point in 1912 when he wrote a book called The Servile State. In it, he contended that the liberal welfare state was designed not so much to help the poor as to provide them with a measure of security which, once it was reinforced with protective legislation, had the effect of, as he wrote, enticing them into a passive pliability, thereby inducing a system of wage slavery. Well, that's all right to hold as a position, but did Hilaire Belloc have anything to combat what the liberals were doing for the poor, or the abuses of what the liberals were doing for the poor? Yes, he did. He and his friend G.K. Chesterton came up with a rather unique idea, political idea we may call it, and the idea was called distributism. This distributist theory that they put forth really envisioned the distribution in a cooperative society, the distribution of property. Now, by property, what Belloc was essentially talking about would be capital and the means of production. Well, this distribution of property to poor people who genuinely need it, and also to give those poor people what was theirs by right, namely dignity, freedom, and power. The most pressing moral problem, said Belloc, was the vice and cancer of capitalism, with its ambiance of ephemeral and empoisoned chaos. And it was a moral issue because the control of wealth was the control of life. He continues, it is always to the advantage of the wealthy to deny general conceptions of right and wrong. And people were even deluded into equating wealth with righteousness, when in fact the pursuit of wealth tended to usurp the pursuit of God. He condemned as monstrous the philosophy which suggested that the indefinite extension of private greed would work out to the advantage of all. Now, many people said, well, that's all right, but here he is criticizing wealthy people. And yet, by the standards of his day, Hilaire Belloc was a comparatively economically comfortable man himself. Yes, that is true. But there's a far cry from his situation and what he was criticizing. It would appear that Hilaire Belloc would not have criticized the individual initiative of hard work, which provided financial success. He would strongly criticize the greed which ignored others and forgot God. Hilaire Belloc, of course, was always at his best when he was fighting. Some of the greatest heroes, or his greatest heroes in the church, were the great fighters, Pope Gregory VII, the Crusaders, St. Dominic, St. Thomas Aquinas, the Jesuits. And he was a man whose faith grew as he became older. When he was a young man, for example, his faith was not nearly as strong as it was when he became an older man. He believed that the church was the continued incarnation of Christ, and he liked to emphasize that the church was a defined living organism which merged and blended in the temporal order, and it blended the eternal concepts and truths of faith with that temporal order in which we were living. He believed that the church was reality and everything outside of it was unreal. Within the church, you had everything that was right-ordered and sane and formative and normal, and everything outside of that was not. Is it any wonder, then, he could write a verse which read, the moral is, it is indeed, you cannot monkey with the creed. Now, that sounds like he's a very traditional man, and he was, but he welcomed things new. He said, they are to me the proof of life. These are part of a living thing in which I am, not a document or a mere record. He kept the Blessed Sacrament in his home reserved at Kingsland, and any time there was an available priest, he would always have the priest offer Mass for him. And beginning the night before Holy Mass, his heart would be filled with joy because the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass was going to be offered in his home. Now, he was not always terribly devout when he was assisting at Mass. Frank Sheed, the great Catholic publisher and a friend of his, noted that during Mass, Hilaire Belloc moved about in his chair. He muttered. He could not take the Mass quietly. There were moods, indeed, in which he could not take anything quietly. When they dedicated the new church at Beaconsfield for his good friend G.K. Chesterton, there were loads of people there, and Belloc came down for the dedication. And this is what Sheed recorded. When a side chapel was being opened to Chesterton's memory in the church at Beaconsfield, there was a great crowd down from London. One could hardly breathe for the press of people standing about. Suddenly, there was a commotion at the back of the church. It was Belloc demanding to go to confession. He thrust his way through, and as he passed me, I heard him say, it's not essential, but it's urgent. He went into the sacristy, told the altar boys to clear out, and made his confession there and then to a priest already vested for the altar. He was indeed a very, very devout man, to say the least. Not always attached to Catholic devotional practices, but attached very, very much to the church as the body of Christ, a living organism, and very, very, very strongly opposed to dissension and controversy and fighting within the church. This body was served by Hilaire Belloc very faithfully and very well. In 1934, Pope Pius XI noted the value of his work by making him a Knight Commander of St. Gregory. When he died, Monsignor Ronald Knox said he was a prophet by destiny and by temperament. And I suppose his old and great friend Frank Sheed summed up very well, and better than others, Hilaire Belloc's contributions. He said he was a wonderful personality, so rich and so various that his opponents could not cope with him. All this went into his battle for the faith, the devotion, the learning, the gaiety, the grandeur, the courage. The total effect was magnificent, and we are all so deep in his debt that our best thanks, are feeble in comparison.